miss you when I
everyone. For today, I'm actually here to discuss Diane Evans, or Sally, who was from my Audrey Horne episode as a turn. But before we get into it, I'll hand over the mic so she can introduce herself further.
Diane, I'm here in the city of Copenhagen recording a podcast about Twin Peaks. Sorry, I just had to do that. My name is Sally Ward. I was on last year, as Colin said, on an episode about Audrey Horne, and I'm really excited to be back to talk about Diane this time. I have a Instagram page called My Life is Twin Peaks. It kind of went on hiatus for a while, but it's come back, and you can just check out all the sort of peaksy stuff I get up to there. Other than that, I'm sort of a all-around creative person who has a background in filmmaking and graphic design, and at the moment, getting into theater in many ways. I am actually debuting as a burlesque dancer in September, where I will come out of the broom closet as a burlesque witch called Misty Glamour, and will sort of, or plan to kind of sort of go on from there and as a performer. And hopefully, at some point, a little bit inspired by the good old Double R Club, our good friends in London, maybe do a Twin Peaks-inspired burlesque act. That would be pretty awesome. And then I, with my husband, Anton Binder, who was on recently talking about Philip Jeffries, check out that episode. It's very good. We are sort of creating these plays together where we are using the fact that Anton is a close-up magician and the fact that I make film and now also I'm sort of becoming a bit of a dancer and burlesque dancer, and we're combining our strengths into a narrative. So we did this show called The Secrets of Jack Roulette back in 2021 at the Brighton Fringe Festival, which has a lot of quite Lynchian kind of stylings to it, but also kind of inspired by film noir and just our own musings and stuff. And we're now sort of revising it and would like to put it on again in the beginning of next year. So that's what we're working on.
To start off with my very first question that I have for Diane, I'm thinking of how in very late in the return, when the Diane Tolpa, she says to the Blue Rose Task Force almost unceremoniously that Janie E is her half-sister. Is there anything about the relationship with the two that should be considered in terms of why they were estranged, or why Dougie, the Dougie Tolpa in particular, and later Dougie Jones would become affiliated with her?
Wonderful question. Well, a little bit later, I'd like to talk a little bit about something to do with Jungian psychology, where you can talk about something called the golden shadow and stuff. And there's a little side note maybe to make about Janie E in that regards and what she maybe signifies. But yeah, to me, on a kind of mundane level, I just think, well, you know, if it's the Tolpa Diane who says that Janie is her sister, maybe that's a little bit of a clue to the fact that maybe Janie is also a Tolpa, and maybe they are both off the lodge in some way. There's something very strange and unreal about the whole Janie and Sonny Jim setup. We know that. We noticed that Sonny Jim gives up to Dougie, and it seems to echo the old man who we also maybe know to be the giant in season two. That is the very first episode of season two, right, when Cooper is lying dying on the floor. So a lot of people have suggested that maybe Sonny Jim is like the spirit of the giant or something. Who knows what's happening there? There's definitely some kind of constructive reality that the original Dougie Tolpa seemed to be living in, that it may have been set up by Mr. C in some way in order to trap the real Cooper when he then comes out after 25 years. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't really sort of, I don't see it as particularly real. I think the connection there has something to do with the large connection.
Those are really great observations that I never would have thought of. I guess for me, when I think of the relationship of Diane and Janie E, I actually take just their estranged relationship as maybe not unlike other dysfunctional families. It's more so just the fact that she's related to her, and that later she'd have to reluctantly work with Mr. C, that all the pieces are put in place for the Dougie Tulpa and for everything for when Mr. C would have to go back in the lodge, that the Dougie Tulpa would be the one that goes in. So I think that's more of like Diane was just basically strong-armed. But I think as far as her early days, it was nothing that was like too out of the ordinary on my end.
Yeah, I suppose if you so sorry, I suppose if you say that they are really sisters, maybe Mr. C just simply thought, well, that's where I'll put Dougie. I'll put her, put him with Diane's sister for some reason. To me, we can also maybe later talk about like why Las Vegas. I have a little bit to say about Las Vegas being maybe the least spiritual place on Earth. So if you are a soul that is supposed to go through the stages of enlightenment and develop and get to a better place, which might be what Cooper's journey is about. Well, then his dark shadow, his Mr. C, his suppressed darkness might put him there because it wants to take over.
Actually, I have a lot to say about Vegas when we get to the turn, but I think for now, just to go on to the first time that Diane really meets Cooper for the first time, it's in My Life, My Tapes, where she meets him on December 19th of 1977, only 1 week after he becomes a special agent. And Cooper describes her as, quote unquote, a saint and a cabaret singer. It doesn't take too long. It's less than a month. It's actually on January 10th of 1978, where Cooper starts to say Diane at the beginning of almost every recording. And I guess the next part I should probably mention is that I think at some point, I know this is the missing pieces I'm going into because there's not really a whole lot to talk about Diane from 1978 till 1988, but there is that moment with Diane and the missing pieces where clearly there was no actress off screen. Was there anything about that romantic interaction or their lack of that should be addressed?
Well, I kind of wrote down like sort of the different incarnations of Diane, and there are several, and you can say that the missing pieces and My Life, My Tapes are their own incarnations that I kind of prefer to a little bit separate from the main story. When it comes to Twin Peaks, I feel like you can edit it like you like because it's a fragmented story. So My Life, My Tapes is fun to look at, but for me it spoils it a little bit because it treats her like a real person, and I think it's a lot more interesting to think about what she signifies for Cooper. So but there are some fun stuff to look at there because there's the whole thing where they go on a date at a Chinese restaurant, and I think later we need to talk about the Asian connection or the Orientalism of Diane as a thing. I'll leave that there. And then this scene in The Missing Pieces where Cooper talks to this absent presence beyond the screen. It's a weird scene. I mean, once again, it kind of suggests, well, there's an actual person sitting there. But what I think is fun about that scene is more what it says about Cooper, because honestly, he's a bit of a douchebag in this scene, I think. Just sort of, it's a weird sort of little bit competitive, little like fun puzzle he's got going there. But he like, what do you say, like, challenges her about, you know, this, she might have done something to the room. I mean, it could suggest that they have a playful relationship or something, but this is something about his attitude. Like, it's so annoying. You know, it's like he solves it and then he says, get some coffee from Sally. And it's like, here's your penalty because I worked it out. And it's just, he's so smart ass in that scene, I think. What do you think about it?
I'll be honest, out of all the scenes from The Missing Pieces, this is easily my least favorite. And I don't think I'm necessarily alone because even people who've done fan edits, they have no idea where to fit it in with the movie. In my opinion, I know that behind the scenes that Kyle MacLachlan, he initially didn't want to reprise the role. And for a while, and even now, if I'm going to be honest, I was kind of convinced that Lynch knew that he didn't want to take on the role. So he wanted to give him just one scene to play the traditional Dale Cooper just to I don't know, have fun or ease into it. I feel like that's the only reason why I feel like that scene exists and why the characterization just feels a tiny bit off, especially with what we have with My Life, My Tapes going forward.
I do still think it kind of marries with the many facets of Cooper because he's not a perfect character, and this is what season three really goes into and tries to discover. And I would say that there are a lot of moments throughout season one and two that informs this retrospectively that Cooper has a dark side, or a kind of a dark side that can both be described as like genuinely dark or just sort of that kind of weird puppy, like a little slightly annoying, like a little too enthusiastic for his own good. Such as like the good old, I don't know where this will lead us, but I have a definite feeling that it will be a place most wonderful and strange. I mean, that's such a lovely saying, but we know where it leads him, and it's not good. And he talks to Hawk, who warns the guy, you may be courageous or however he says it, in this world, but there are worlds beyond this that you don't know about. So I think it marries with it. It's just a bit, it's just such a divorced scene from the rest. It's kind of hard to imagine where it would even fit in. So I'm happy it got dropped on the cutting room floor.
Because I like pretty much everything else from the missing pieces. It's really just this one scene that I feel like that doesn't really click with not only with other media of Twin Peaks, but even with Fire Walk Me and the missing pieces in of itself. But it is around 4 months later that he asked Diane out to dinner on June 10th of 1988. And I have to bring up this quote because I didn't even think about it the first time I read it, but the second time there were serious, not quite red flags, but the real dynamic of the relationship started to come in. So Diane at the beginning of one of the chapters says, "Special Agent Cooper, Dale and I had dinner once. We ate Chinese. We had wonton soup, egg rolls, and Peking duck. That's the one where they inflate the bird with air, swallow it over, double its original size. Without a doubt, the most delicious skin I've ever eaten, firm and at the same time delicate. The meat itself takes on a flavor when slid into the mouth. Well, I couldn't get enough of it." Now, I have no idea how this like went over my head the first time, but this is like the most obviously sexually charged thing to start off. And this is in 1991, just with Scott Frost kind of leading the direction of Diane, and how much I think this retroactively fits in with the return. I know that Lynch, he's never really been one to really go through the books, but I imagine that maybe Mark Frost, because Scott Frost is his brother, maybe he was kind of going through it and felt it was good to integrate that. Was there anything about the either whether the in-universe or behind the scenes aspects of the very implied sexual relationship with Diane and Cooper at this time?
It's a while since I read My Life, My Tapes, but I sort of like brushed through it, and I remember a lot about it. It's a memorable book. I don't, and once again, like I sort of edited in and out of my interpretation of Twin Peaks, and mostly kind of disregarded because I think it's a little too just blatantly like it's not so interesting to have everything explained to you, but the book is very concerned with Cooper's sexuality throughout. Like it's all about this slight I hate to use mental health terms wrongly, but if you can say slightly autistic in his sort of pick the way he sort of very technically picks apart life in general. And I think that really comes across throughout the book. He just treats everything sort of like something to work out in a way. So he puts himself through sleep deprivation to find out like what does that do to you? And then he also has that weird moment with somebody, I can't remember where it is, where they have sex for like 24 hours or several days or something, where so he's just really like trying. I mean, it's also spiritual in a sense because it's about sort of taking your body and like pushing it to its limits and stuff like that. He is a spiritual person or sort of spiritually inclined and very interested in esoteric subjects, but he has that very technical approach to all these things. Yeah, so the book is about sexuality, and so I think it just seems to imply that there's some naughty business going on between the two, but as it seems to sort of come across, and based on what we get subsequently in season one or two, this was an affair that probably didn't last. It was almost like friends meeting for a bit, and that's it.
Actually, one of the things that was very interesting when I did the research for this episode is that while filming, David Lynch did tell Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan that Gordon Cole, but not Albert, knew about their secret romance, which I feel like that's kind of an interesting thing to bring up just because of like how Gordon Cole, especially when he gets to the return, how there's this, all knowing is not the right word, but there's something very important when Gordon Cole knows something that, say, Albert does not. Were there any thoughts about whether it was like a fling or if there was something else that was going on, whether it was at this point 1988 or onward?
Yeah, that's again where when we get to this a bit later, I'd like to talk more about the kind of psychological marriage between these two characters and less so about what's really happening on a plot level. But on the plot level, well, yeah, there's a relationship implied. And maybe I can say already, well, what we find is a Cooper who's just a little too concerned with other things. I mean, he's got this ulterior motive that drives him, and that takes over completely at the end of season three. Maybe we can then already just reference the scene where Diane and Cooper goes to the 4:30 mark before they become Richard and Linda. There's a tension in that scene where you can definitely feel that Diane isn't really emotionally happy about the situation. And she's warning Cooper, you know, when we cross, things can be different. But even so, he seems to ignore her and is just completely focused on his task. So there is love. Oh, I actually will, once again, we'll get back to this, but I also want to point out that very important moment in season three where they go to meet Mr. C, and this is Tulpa Diane. This is not the real Diane, but I think she is an extension of the real Diane, and she informs us to us a little bit who Diane might be, even if she's sort of the extreme negative of Diane. There's nothing here, she says, and points to her chest. That's how she knows there's something wrong with this guy, Mr. C, who they all think is Cooper naturally at the time. They don't know that there can actually be a copy of yourself wandering, walking around in the world at this point. So the way she is able to sense that is the fact that there is no heart, there's no feeling, there's no love. So love definitely figures into their relationship very much. But yeah, what can I say? It's a platonic nah, who knows? It's definitely not a committed relationship, but there is a relationship there that is definitely somehow a bit eternal, it seems. Like it doesn't go away. But I think Cooper fucks it up by changing everything.
I think he kind of messes it up even before that because we're just talking about like their relationship as of 1988. And admittedly, she's not really a heavy part of My Life, My Tapes from this point onward. So we kind of just have to move on to the original series where naturally Diane's not in it, but she's like such a fascinating part because Cooper has every tape that he presumably sends off to her. But what makes it so interesting, just in retrospect, is that here's someone we had a romantic fling with, at least. Not sure how much the romantic feelings were, from June of 88 up until this point. But the fact that he's not just talking about the Laura Palmer case, but during this time, he does talk about his thoughts on Audrey and Annie, which are explicitly romantic and how compromised he feels. Do you have any thoughts about where Diane lies in terms of, having to listen to these tapes of just both professional and personal work? And also the fact that he's talking about other women after they had a thing together a year prior.
Yeah, so again, naturally, if we consider Diane to be a quote unquote real person, you can only imagine that all of this must be a bit strange to deal with. But I don't know. I mean, when they meet Tulpa, Diane, Gordon, and Albert, I can't remember how Gordon says it, but he seems to say something like she was always a bit of a feisty one or something like that. There's a suggestion that she's quite a strong woman. So who knows? It's maybe equal measures, emotional and toughness and all that. I don't know how she would dealt with it, but I think it's more interesting to think about what, like, once again, what she signifies for Cooper as a kind of confessor. But I think we will get back to that. So it's more interesting, like what, like the kinds of thoughts that he gives her and shares with her. Essentially, it's all his most intimate, but also most practical thoughts. So the women in Cooper's life play a big part, all these different women, and for different reasons. And that's why he talks about them to his confessor or his heart.
And actually, this is a strange thing for my last note relating to the original series, but one of the things that she does, that she actually does send over to Cooper, it's I believe it's near the end of season one. It's when the Norwegians where they're partying, and Cooper has the tape up to show how loud it actually is, and he's like, "Diane, can you please send me earplugs overnight?" And she actually does, and I didn't even think about it until John Bernardi on Blue Rose Task Force talked about it. Where, this isn't like now where it's like you have Amazon shipping, like, promptly, or drone shipping or anything like that. That in 1989 that you couldn't really do this. To me, I always accepted that the FBI, that there's certain things that are high priority, so it could be sent promptly. But since you mentioned that Diane, there's that debate if it's like a real person in some cases. Do you have any thoughts on either the fun logistical aspects of this, or if there's something about how Diane influences Cooper directly during the original series?
Yeah, it both kind of proves or disproves the fact that she's a real person. So I actually hadn't thought about like the high priority thing. So maybe she could actually send him something so quickly. But you also have to think about that the tapes have to get to her first. So I think it sort of also underlines what I like about it, which is that maybe this isn't realistic in any way, and this is more magical and in a lovely way to the story. So this is just unrealistically fast, and I think it kind of helps that idea because, and that's what I mean about My Life, My Tapes, is that, well, she's just treated like a real person, and that's fine, and we do see a manifestation of her in season three. That's like or several manifestations of her as if she is a real person, but it's much more interesting what kind of role she plays to Cooper. So if I were to explain it logically, I would say that she's his confessor, and she is a word for his way of addressing the things that he's dealing with. So both, once again, his practical thoughts, but also his feelings. So on a practical level, he's making sense of the murder case when he talks to Diane. But you know, there's nothing to say that between the scenes we've seen that he picked up the phone and actually called the head office and said, "I need some earplugs. Can you send them to me?" Even if that was an actual secretary called Diane, you know, that received them, it's just to say maybe this is just his way of saying, "Oh yeah, I need to remember to get to do that," and then he goes off and picks up a phone.
That is actually a really good point. I didn't even think about like the fact that the tapes were even sent back. I think I just had this, I just assumed that like, or not assumed, but I just accepted that, oh, he asked them and then they just come. And it just I don't know. It's crazy how it took me years to even think about that.
Yeah, that's actually very nice because it leads me to talk about this kind of techno magic that we see throughout Twin Peaks, first seen as this weird computer that Wyndham Earle has, and then later it's the technology that Mr. C works with, which it just doesn't seem real. This is not realistic technology in any way. And so once again, this also implies, you know, that Cooper is he is a bit of a wizard as well, or like a magician. You know, he's on this kind of journey through life, and he wants to connect with the higher forces of the world, and he does in his own way wield this piece of magical technology, which is called Diane, that, you know, he can talk into, and it can be received by somebody else, even though we know it's a tape record or a dictaphone. It's not actually something that sends anything. He also has that funny little is a BlackBerry or something. It's some kind of pocket computer from the time I read about it on, I think, probably 12 Rainbow Trout dealt with it. And it's a real thing, but it's more like he types in, "He did not do it," about James Hurley, I believe. Oh no, not James Hurley,
Oh, Bobby
Bobby, right?
Briggs.
Onto it. And this is something about the choice to kind of use this little piece of machinery to communicate with. And there's more, many more examples in season three. And that leads me to talk about quickly, just to jump ahead very quickly, to Tolbert Dayan and NATO, because I think they also have an affinity with technology, both of them. So the reversed Dayan in through Tolbert Dayan that we see in season three is now no longer someone who receives information, but one that delivers information. So she works as this kind of double agent for Mr. C. And she has her phone, which, like, again, nothing realistic about it. Like, she types in the coordinates and then she sees a map of Twin Peaks, unlike anything that we have in our real world. Like, it's weird the way it zooms in. Also, the when Mr. C is looking at the map on his computer, like, it's really movie science in a way, but I like to think of it as magical technology. And then you have NATO, who seems to understand the technology of the Lodge, because she seems very savvy in what she does. She seems to know what she's up to. She warns Cooper not to go through the wrong socket, the wrong portal, and she leads him to the roof of this place they're in, and pulls a switch. And the way she looks at him, obviously she has no real sort of face, but she seems to be looking at him, and that suggests to me that she knows what she's doing. So she pulls the switch, and she knows that it's gonna eject her from the story, so to speak. It's gonna affect her. So she quote unquote sacrifices herself for Cooper in that moment. It just suggests to me that she knows what she's doing. So I think that's really cool. That really fits with the fact that you can think of Diane in season one and two as an actual dictaphone that later becomes a person.
That is actually really remarkable. And actually, since we were talking about Mr. C for a little bit, my next notes, or my first notes after the events of the original series, it's actually what the Dayan Tolba says to the Blue Rose Task Force, where at some point in 1992 or 1993, Mr. C visits Dayan in Philadelphia and he's grilling her with questions, but she mistakes it for excitement just because naturally it's her first time seeing him in years. But she says that when they kissed, everything changed about the mood, and that's when he subsequently assaulted her. And I think this actually kind of parallels with the Part 18 drive in some way. But after this, she is taken to the room above the convenience store, which she only refers to a gas station. And this is where I would imagine the Tolpa was created. I know there's a lot of, quite frankly, intense stuff to talk about here, but do you have any particular thoughts about how Diane dealt with Mr. C and everything from now that we're getting to the Tolpas?
Yeah, so obviously there's a little bit of a gap where you have to assume that this dictaphone then was a person, but like a manifestation of her in the real world. And then Mr. C comes along, and what I believe happens there plot-wise is that he sends her to the lodge as NATO, because at the end of season three, Diane, the supposed real Diane, comes out of NATO. Like directly, like we see that when Cooper kisses her, it's Diane that's hidden inside NATO's body. So I think he sends her to the lodge the same way that even though all of the aspects of Cooper are Cooper, Mr. C is also Cooper, but Cooper's sort of consciousness, you can call that in Jungian terms, ego, his conscious self is probably in Doggy's body, because that's the one that's trapped in the lodge, and that's the one we follow as Cooper throughout the story. But all the other things are archetypal aspects of him. But like, so the conscious Diane is sent to the lodge, and in her place is Atoba.
And since we're getting to the realm of the return now, I know we brushed up a little bit about Janie E, Sonny Jim, why there would be the Dougie Tolpin layer, the Dougie Jones Tolpa. Was there anything we should keep in mind about Janie E from these events onward because the Tolpa is now formed and now she's at least working indirectly with the Jones family?
Yeah, I have a hard time with that one, really. Like, there can be multiple reasons. Like I said, I think, on a mundane level, potentially Mr. C, because he's manipulating Diane clearly. Like, he's got full control of her, so maybe it makes sense to use her sister as the other one to kind of keep track of Cooper as in Dougie's body or as Dougie. But there's nothing to suggest that Janie E is in any way working with Mr. C. Clearly, there's nothing that seems to suggest that he's has done anything other than just send him into this body that is almost not of use. He doesn't know that the Lodge is holding a hand over him and making him quote unquote very, very lucky. He works at Lucky Seven Insurance, and he's just extremely lucky all the time. He wins a lot of money and all sorts of things. And actually finds a way to come out of this prison, so to speak. But so maybe he just didn't think it through, Mr. C, who knows? But yeah, I don't know. I simply don't know. Maybe he just sent her there because sent him there because it was convenient in some way. And the fact that they're strange means that they're not going to talk to each other. But it seems a bit stupid, doesn't it? Because, you know, who, like, obviously, Albert and Gordon are going to seek Diane out whenever these kind of things unfold. And as we know, eventually, this ring that is inside Major Briggs's stomach is going to turn up. But he didn't know that. He didn't know that, obviously. But, like, the whole connection between the families is, like, is a little bit too much of a clue, isn't it? So I can't really answer that other than maybe that you can say that, well, this is just a plot, and then there's a, again, like what the whole story is about, which is not anything to do with realism, but more to do with a journey that these characters are on. And the whole point is that it's very flawed. And so Mr. C is also not this kind of perfect mastermind. He's actually really easy to trick, isn't he? I can't personally make too much sense of the whole coordinate thing because I'm like, well, if you know that they're out to get you, why don't you just leave it? But that's to do with the Judy thing, isn't it? Everyone wants to find Judy. So he's as curious as everyone else, but like, isn't it that the mother of Abomination wants to have sex with Bob? And so maybe it's not a good deal for him. I don't know. So he's just, he goes down this path that's like clearly gonna set him in a trap, and he does, and he gets destroyed, doesn't he? I just feel like it doesn't make sense. It's on purpose. It's just what the story is.
I do agree that Mr. C is not like quote unquote like the ultimate mastermind. I think that when I think of why Janie E was a factor into this, because we were just talking about, like I said, very intense subject matter about him assaulting Diane and then taking her to the room of the, you know, above the convenience store. I always kind of thought that this is something that Mr. C is doing to just basically add insult to injury to Diane, that it's like now family's involved. And that was the thing that took precedent now that the plan is like effectively settled because of it. You know, it's like he has like 20, we'll say 20-ish years to kind of settle when these things come up. But I think in that exact moment in the early 90s that it was just to inflict more pain and suffering, or pain and sorrow for that matter, onto Diane since she is going into the Black Lodge.
True. Yeah, it's almost, you could see that it's a potential extortion moment. He has sort of tried to make up a lot of sort of back doors to his plan. So once again, they're flawed, but like he does have ulterior motives. So yeah, I mean, he could be using it as some kind of extortion later on if he needed to. The fact is just that he seems to have created this Talbot that he also controls and in that way almost has programmed, quote unquote. And so we know that he is able to send her these quote unquote magical words that will trigger certain reactions and stuff. So he seems to be on top of her in many ways.
And this is actually one that sort of mirrors Cooper's arc in the near the end of the return. But I'm thinking how at the end of part 16, when the Diane Tulpa, she's returned to the Black Lodge, or at least the waiting room. And of course that's where like her arc effectively ends. But then we have in part 17, after Freddy defeats the Bob Orb, that we see Diane, the quote unquote real Diane, emerge. Did you have any thoughts about what Diane, like the, you know, what she had to deal with from the early 90s up until this event of being released in the sheriff's station? Because it's a long, you know, that's a good 20 plus years. And on top of that, I think my hang up is that she has these feelings reemerge for Cooper, like these like romantic feelings. It feels like there's a lot to take in after like all the stuff she's been through in at least the Red Room.
Yeah, it really feels like unrequited love, doesn't it? And once again, I'll get back to more what it might mean on a spiritual level, what these characters are going through. But yeah, I mean, he's totally taken advantage of this person. He's just using her. And so again, on a plot level, you can say when they make love, or I would say have sex, they don't make love because there's no true love there. When they have sex, it's because she's indulging his thing that he wants to do, like a lot of other characters. But you can just imagine having sex with someone who looks like the person who raped you, so that even if you know it's not really him, it looks like him. And I will also point out the fact that when he comes, like he goes through the door and then he says, "I'll see you at the curtain call," and a lot of stuff happens. I think that's when he goes and changes the course of events, and he comes out through the Glastonbury Grove curtains, and he meets Diane, and she asks, "Is it really you?" So obviously, I mean, throughout the whole season, you've had a lot of people changing their personality and going back and forth. And they already know at this point that the next thing that's going to happen is that something's going to change. They don't necessarily know that they're going to be different people, but they know things are going to definitely change for them. So obviously you would be having to really make sure who they say they are and stuff. But it's been such a long time. So like, who is he and where has he been, and is it really him, and or is it the other guy or the third guy? So even with his reassurance, not a lot of reassurance comes, and she doesn't feel very good about the whole situation. So I think once again she indulges him, but she doesn't like it. And during the act, that kind of trauma is being triggered. So I understand, Diane. I would get the fuck out of there. I think the fact that she sees herself leave, because who is this doppelganger that she sees at the motel? I think that's just her, or the person called Linda already leaving. And that's just in her mind making the decision already before she even goes into the room. I'm gonna get the fuck out of here.
Honestly, yeah, that's a lot of great insight, especially about the Linda part. I think what makes a lot of this feel like such a blur is because of when Diane, like I said, the quote unquote real Diane emerges in part 17. If I had to say there's one part where Lynch is potentially telling the audience that this is like, I guess, an unreliable narrator, it's probably this scene because everything's all the loose ends seem to tie up. He sees Diane, they kiss like in front of everyone. Then we have the Cooper, imposed saying we live inside a dream. So when we get to part 18, it makes when she says, "Is it really you?" It makes that like almost like a strange scene. And I think one of the things that I think about that kind of compounds it is that they go from Glastonbury Grove to it seems like a bittersweet reunion when they're in Glastonbury Grove, but then it like hard cuts to they're just driving. I mean, you could always make the argument that he hotwired a car, or Diane did, or they made the trek to do that. But do you have any thoughts about that jump between Glastonbury Grove and the car? Because it feels like it's the they could hotwire that car, but there's just something about, I think, the whole we live inside a dream and everything we see after that.
I think this is where we're watching a film or a TV show, right? And there are these interesting things happening in the edit that where you can, I mean, this is, it's also kind of in the nature of the entirety of Twin Peaks, especially season three, and everything that David Lynch does. It's the abstraction, and that's why it informs so many interpretations, because stuff is missing. There are missing pieces. And even though he's giving us some of the missing pieces, it hasn't given us all of the missing pieces. There are many, 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 many blanks that are. Some people, I recently saw some people talking about the script. Or was that maybe one of your guests who talked about they thought that the original script of Fire Walk With Me was just this like completely cohesive story, and then a lot of things were taken out. I think I disagree with that personally. I know that Stanley Kubrick supposedly approached The Shining that way, that he made a film and then he took scenes out to create that abstraction, but I don't believe that that's how Lynch works. I think this is already happening on a script level. You know, a lot of pieces are kind of being stuck together. The abstractions don't get stuck together by a classic storytelling, but rather through little bits and pieces that are scattered out throughout the whole thing, which then leads me to, well, what could have happened in that edit, in that moment between the two? Maybe that's the fireman scene, which is the very, very first scene we see in part one, where Cooper is sitting with the fireman. Not necessarily, because the thing about that scene is, what's interesting about it is that it's in black and white, and the only other black and white moments, other than perhaps the Monica Bellucci dream, which has to do with the past, because we see all the Philip Jeffries stuff from Fire Walk With Me, that the only other part that is in black and white is when Cooper goes into the past. So it kind of suggests that potentially that meeting with the fireman happens around that time, because he says the things that are important to this whole next section, which is remember 4:30, Richard and Linda. But what I like about the fact that it's the first thing that we see is that it suggests the Mobius strip, the figure eight, the infinity sign, construction of the whole story, which suggests that this is something that probably happens over and over and over, potentially in different incarnations, but definitely, even though the lights go out in the end, that's not necessarily the end. Actually, the lights go out at the Palmer house, but it's not the end. The next thing we see is Laura whispering to Cooper, right? So, and this is an image we've seen multiple times. So it just suggests to me that it all starts over. So that just led me off on a whole tangent about what happens in that edit. I don't know, but that's just to say, like, maybe that's one of the things that happens around that time. But what does it mean? I have no idea. Did they hotwire a car? Probably. It's just because the things that happen between those two scenes aren't important, I think.
That's fair enough, but I think one thing that is worth addressing is actually before it's actually before Cooper goes to rescue Laura. It's of course, after the Bob Orb is defeated, we have Cooper, Goran Cole, and Diane, where they're suddenly in the basement of the Great Northern. And I always took it as he trusts Cole and Diane more than anyone else that we see throughout all three seasons and Fire Walk With Me. And I think that with Cole, of course, it's his boss. They have like a great, like, quirky relationship. But I think with Diane, there's something about that intimacy that they had in 1988 that I think the fact that he could talk into this recorder, he could share all these vulnerable thoughts, because you did bring up a good point that these tapes aren't just sent back instantly, like we talked about with the earplugs. But I think that in my mind, these tapes do get back to her. And the fact that he can share so many vulnerable things to her, both personally and professionally, I think it makes perfect sense for her to make it to the basement of the Great Northern, and also why she would be there in Glastonbury Grove. But to kind of go on with part 18, though, is that you were right about talking about, like, when he says that things will all be different, where this is really his mission, not hers. She's just tagging along. He does this in the motel, but I think he asked to give her a kiss before they even go in, so it's all really on Cooper's terms that this is all happening.
Yeah, I'll get back to all of this, but I will just very quickly say, like, if Diane is quote unquote Cooper's heart or his love or his what Jung would call his anima, I think Cooper knows that he's supposed to bring her, but he just does it in a backwards way, and he projects her outwards, and I'll explain what I mean about that later. So once again, he treats her really badly because she's sitting there, she's got trepidations, and she says, when we cross, everything might be different. And he basically ignores her, and then he just says, kiss me. Because he knows that he might not see her again, but it doesn't feel very genuine, does it? It's just like, let's just get this out of the way. I'm just gonna acknowledge that you're there, but you know, this other stuff is much more important. My love is projected outwards onto my whole thing about Laura Palmer and the women who are in trouble. Yeah, I'll get back to this, but it's all about Cooper's hero complex and his treatment of women and the way he wants to save them. So, you know, they're only interesting to him when he can save them. So Diane is trapped in Nato's body. He doesn't even notice. He doesn't recognize her, I believe, when he meets her in the largest Nato. But the fireman knows, and he makes sure she gets there. And it's not until he like notices that she's standing there that he realizes that maybe there's something going on there. So he's just totally oblivious to all of this. But it, like, that's when he gives her the light of day, and that's when he sort of gives her probably the most genuine kiss, is like as Nato, or when she comes out as Diane in that moment, because she needed his help. And I would say it's the same with Audrey all the way back. You know, it's like that's why they don't end up together, because she's too independent for him. And it's only when she's in trouble, i.e., trapped at One Eye Jack's, that she gets the light of day. And when she's been saved, and you move on with your life, don't you? Then you need to find the actual woman in trouble, who is then Annie, who desperately needs him, but not for any healthy reason.
I think there's something that's very telling about how Annie, when she is rescued from the Black Lodge in the season two finale, I think it's very telling how we're this is a little bit behind the scenes, but how Annie's just not in the return at all. Like I think there's something like almost like with Cooper, how that kind of coincides with the idea that, oh yeah, she was rescued and we don't really need her anymore. I mean, of course, you know, we have the missing pieces and then the Mark Frost books, but in terms of what we see in the return, it's like it just kind of adds that idea that once Cooper, he can never really settle with one woman, or even like with in part 16, where he doesn't hesitate to make a tulpa of himself to take care of Janie E and Sonny Jim, but that doesn't change the fact that he himself is not going to be there for them.
Yes, I totally agree with all of that stuff. Like, it's so like Annie's destiny is so tragic, and his shadow, Mr. C, mocks the fact, how's Annie? How's Annie? Like, you know, who gives a fuck about Annie? It's just pure. Okay, I'm gonna be so rough on Cooper now, but like, it's just pure destruction. And we love him so much, but he's a very flawed character. But this is what's interesting about this story. He's a complex character with both positives and negatives and all that. But he's very flawed, and he leaves all of the women in total despair, because I do not believe that he does anything good for Laura Palmer at the end. You know, she got her angel. I know she died, but she got her angel, and she seemingly ascended to some kind of higher consciousness, because when she unmasks herself in the lodge to him, she's just pure white light. So how does he dare go and meddle with that?
I think to build off of Laura and how it factors with Diane is that I think it's maybe not funny, but I think there's something really peculiar about she has to go on this odyssey with him to Odessa because he failed rescuing her previously. So he's not even like it's not even like anything she agreed to. It's not like she was that tangentially interested in the Laura Palmer case beyond just getting the tapes and just kind of hearing him out. But I think that's what makes it like, you know, in part 18 when they do go to the motel, where she sees, you actually brought up a great point that's Linda just on her way out already. But there is something that I always found incredibly unsettling about seeing Laura Dern just emerge and then just effectively disappear. And then we have the upcoming is like the next scene, which actually gets creepier each time I rewatch it when they do go in the motel. Because, you know, it is, even though with Cooper, even though that quirkiness was receding away after the events of part 17, it's not quite Mr. C, but this is definitely not the Cooper that we knew for the two previous parts, because he just says very mechanically, "I want you to make love with me." And we have the scene with the Platters, their son is performing. And it's just like this cold, dead look. Diane is very clearly not enjoying any of this, like to the point where she has to like cover his face. And of course, I can't ignore Angelo Badalamenti's like, you know, malevolent music that plays and then comes back to the Platters. I don't think anyone really finds this a comfortable scene, but it's one of the few sex scenes that gets even more uncomfortable like every time I rewatch it.
Yeah, it's pretty horrible. And Lynch likes to use music in a kind of contrasting way. So the song is really a romantic. It's also the song we hear in part eight. So that's sort of like, I think plot-wise, it's sort of echoing some of that, which we don't even like the whole sex magic thing. You only really truly know about if you read the secret history, but you can maybe imagine that, okay, this act is sort of opening this gateway to where they end up afterwards. But the song ironically says, "My prayer is to linger with you." But I just feel like Diane's prayer as she's looking into the ceiling and covering up Cooper's face is just like, "I just want to get out of here."
And she pretty much does the next day. That's when, quote unquote, Richard wakes up and he gets the note from Linda. Did you have any thoughts about Diane, about like her disappearance and how this factors into part 18 onward?
Yes. So again, I keep saying I'll come back to this, but that's because I think I need to talk about this approach, specific approach I have to it. But I can just sort of right now, off the top of my head, say, you know, like, yeah, she's a crucial part to the story. And so this is why Cooper is just so lost and so not like, well, I mean, any person is supposed to go through change. Change is good. But this is not good change. Like he's just like lost himself. And that's why I think Diane is just so crucial to that. And I think that's what Mark Frost and David Lynch know. That's why she has to be there at the end. You can maybe say that behind the scenes, there's something about David Lynch loving this union between Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern that probably goes back to Blue Velvet. And there's maybe just a beautiful image that is being indulged at the end where he gets to put these two characters that he loves into that. Many have suggested that there's almost a way where you could see Blue Velvet as like the prequel to season three in a way. Almost, okay, now I'm kind of ignoring my life, my tapes, but almost suggesting that this relationship goes way back and is kind of eternal in a way between these like college sweethearts or whatever. And it's all about the problem that she's being put in by this guy who's always much more interested in these exotic but dark forces. So Isabella Rossellini's character, Dorothy Valance, is so much more interesting, and he leaves behind the girl he should be with, his age-appropriate, consciousness-appropriate girlfriend. But and I think that just sort of continues into the end of season three. I think it's more than that. I think that, yeah, you can sort of say that there is something about Lynch just wanting to see this happening, but I think it's also about Lynch and Mark Frost realizing how important Diane is to the whole story as this thing, this vessel that Cooper has poured his heart and soul into throughout the whole show.
I do agree that I have actually looked at Blue Velvet as a spiritual prequel to Twin Peaks. Even like taking the return out of the equation for a moment, you could see this being Jeffrey Beaumont's like basically first foray into injustice and what would lead him to be in something like the FBI. But strangely enough, this particular part in part 18, I actually think of Mulholland Drive, and I have to thank Joel Bocco for this because he was nice enough to have me on a show last year. And we were talking about the parallels of Part 18 and Mulholland Drive. And the one that I brought up is that when Richard wakes up, it's not unlike when Betty wakes up in Mulholland Drive and she's now Diane, where the love interest has now disappeared effectively, or at least is a different person. But, you know, in the case of Part 18, Linda does actually disappear and we never see her again. So I've always tried to wrestle with the fact of, with that in mind, how I should look at Mulholland Drive and Part 18 more specifically. And because of that, it's actually raised more questions than answers in a good way for both Richard and Carrie Page. But because Linda's off screen, I kind of gloss that over every now and then. But yeah, I always thought there was
Yeah,
something interesting about that in particular.
I think it's something that he deals with in his whole body of work. So also Lost Highway with its different realities, and maybe Inland Empire is, at least to my eyes, like the most complex sort of exploration of all that, where you have like stories within stories. It's called Inland Empire. It's really just like the journey into the psyche, and it's manifested in multiple layers and. There's so many corridors to walk down, signified in Twin Peaks by the many, many corridors you have to walk down. I mean, every time I watch the change between the moment they kill Bob and Cooper getting to where he needs to go. I mean, there's so many doorways and so many characters you need to interact with and who need to take you places. It's really complex. And I can't really make sense of that other than to say, like, yeah, it's because it's a really intricate universe to traverse. And so I really like what you said there, because one of the most typical readings of Mulholland Drive is to say that everything you see at the end is the reality and everything that came before is the dream. And of course, the major question we asked about Twin Peaks is who is the dreamer? And we are told that we live inside a dream. And so it makes us question what reality even is. And I will point out that when I went to visit Snoqualmie and North Bend, aka the real Twin Peaks, I felt that the sights that we see of Twin Peaks at the very end of part 18, when he's brought Carrie Page there, looks a lot more geographically like the real Twin Peaks. That's not to say that we are in our reality necessarily, but we are in a very similar reality. This is, of course, also emphasized by the fact that we know that outside of the story, the person who opens the door in the guise of Alice Tremond is the real owner of the Laura Palmer house, Mary Reber, who we also went to visit, which was amazing. So there's just a lot to sort of cement it a little bit more in our reality. But like, I also think, like, I don't like to go too far down that road because, like, oh, what is Agent Cooper or Richard, like a real guy who has this, like, who lives in our world, who has this trauma that he's dealing with? Yeah, potentially. But I don't want to go too far towards reality on the spectrum. It's just more that these are all different experiences. And I think that's where the whole sentence, who is the dreamer, is so important. It's to do with a person's perception. So you can say that Mulholland Drive deals with potentially someone's preferred perception of what happened. And then you can say, so is Lost Highway. I mean, Lost Highway is very explicit in that when it has its protagonist say almost right at the beginning, something like, I prefer to remember things the way I like, or something like that. And then you go on to show this version of what happened where he is the better person and where she is this horrible woman that has taken advantage of him. And this is just probably some way to come to terms with a horrible guilt around his murder that he has committed. So yeah, I haven't really explored like flipping it on the head and saying the entirety of Twin Peaks is a dream. And somewhere outside of that, there's a real person. I think maybe, I haven't read it personally, but I think maybe in one of the Blue Rose magazines, John Fawn, I think, possibly wrote an article about this, or somebody. I think it was John Fawn potentially who wrote this whole article about basically there's a guy who committed a murder. He murdered Laura Palmer, and all of the Twin Peaks we see is basically just his fantasy. So that is a reading to be had.
Actually, I think that was the one. I think the big crux, if it is the John Thorne I'm referring to, I think it's the one where he had to take into account that the FBI pen that Cooper had, it was missing for the first 16 parts, but only comes out like very later on. But actually, Jeremiah from Take the Ring, he did a video about Judy, and he actually did have a similar enough sentiment where he was actually talking more explicit about when Richard wakes up. That this is the closest iteration to the real Dale Cooper, and that everything else was like a dream. I might be misphrasing it, but I do remember that he did talk about how Richard is the closest to like the real Dale Cooper, because what we see in the original series, or even a little bit in The Return, is like this quirky, upbeat guy. And then, of course, we have Mr. C as well, which is like the most wrathful, evil that you could possibly embody in a character like that. But then you have Richard, where he has more of a, I guess like a, it's kind of like a balance of the two, where it's like there's more of an intensity to him, but it's not like evil like Mr. C, and of course he's not like upbeat in any capacity.
Yeah, I will once again just come back to that when I sort of go through this a particular approach I have. But I totally agree with that he is equal measures both, like, he's just a flawed person, right? Like, he seems He's not necessarily a bad person, because I noticed the fact, he isn't so excited about this coffee he's drinking the way Cooper is. It's probably a bit more realistic, because I tried the coffee in Snoqualmie, and it's not necessarily damn fine. I mean, the whole thing is, when you go to a diner, I mean, I'm saying this as someone who comes from Europe, and where diners is sort of a novelty to visit, but I've been to diners in the US, and I know what the concept is, which is you've got this coffee burning all day long, and it's not good coffee. It's engine oil. It is yeah, it's the engine oil from Black Glastonbury Grove. It's the Garmonbosia you go and sort of just pep yourself up with. It's got the sting of the 24-hour blend, as they say in Fire Walk With Me. So, like, this reaction, what the heck is that even? But, someone who is a balanced person doesn't have to be overly excited or overly depressed about things necessarily. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to just be happy with something. Just drink something and enjoy it, and not have to sort of go, damn, fine. This is the best, best thing that ever happened to him. But then, right after that, we see this guy who beats up these cowboys, and he can really handle himself seemingly at first, but then he just seems kind of awkward, and he, like, he takes the guns and he puts them in the cooking oil, and it's almost like he's not quite sure what he's doing, really, and stuff. So, and you can say maybe that's also realistic, but it's also like very extreme and very kind of macho and stuff, and a bit toxic. So, yeah, who is this guy?
In terms of Richard, out of all that stuff that you mentioned, I think the him putting the guns in the deep fryer, that part I was fine with, but I think it was the fact that it was sort of this weird juxtaposition of him not being hesitant about pointing the gun to the waitress, but then also he tells the guys like, "Hey, I don't know if he'll fire the bullets, but you should probably move away." It is again that weird imbalance of him, and also you kind of wonder about like, I guess at this point we can't really talk about Diane, but more so Linda. Like, if that's a factor in any of this, because again, I know that Part 18, it's so multifaceted about how you can talk about it, how Diane or how Linda factors into it, that it does raise more questions than answers. But I know you said before you wanted to mention about like how Las Vegas is like the least spiritual place like that you could ever go to. Did you have any thoughts about anything you want to say, whether it does or does not tie into Twin Peaks?
Yeah, well, if it's okay, I have this little approach to the things we've already kind of covered, but it's just an angle. And we've talked about most of it already, but I think I need to kind of go through the story chronologically, because basically what I've been looking at is the idea from Jungian psychology, which is the concept of the anima and the animus. Just to be very quick about that, essentially, Jung's theories are all about having this kind of animist approach to the human psyche, where he says that the human psyche consists of many archetypes that represent the different parts of us. And becoming a whole person, a balanced person, individual, is all about the communication between these different aspects of us. And there are many, many psyches, but archetypes, but there are seven major ones that are important, and I'll mention some of them in view of this stuff. But the anima and the animus are archetypes that live deep within our subconscious, that in very broad terms are often defined as the feminine and masculine side of our consciousness. Personally, I find that a little bit reductive, but it's just a way to kind of symbolize these two aspects. And basically, the whole thing is that it's about this balancing of these two sides within you that leads to higher consciousness. But another way to look at the anima and the animus is to say that the anima is, you can call it the soul, and I'll get back to how you can then see that. You can call it love, the heart, but you can more than anything, the energy is an inward going in energy. It relates to your inner reality. So you can say the feminine principle is one that goes inward. And another image for that would be the moon. The moon subtracts, but the sun has an outward going energy. So the anima is the sun and the quote unquote masculine and principle that moves outwards. But it's also the spirit, and it's also what you would call logos, reasoning. It's a very traditional idea of kind of masculine traits of being someone who acts and has a very reasonable and rational approach to the world. But once again, I find these things a little bit old-fashioned in a way, by the way that with Jung, the thing he says is that we have both traits in us, but heterosexual normative man needs to look at his animus in order to integrate it into him, because he has a lot of, no, sorry, anima, his feminine side. He has a lot of animus energy, a lot of masculine energy, and he needs to look at his anima in order to integrate it. And vice versa, women have a lot of anima energy, and they need to look at their animus in order to integrate it. But I would suggest that we probably live in a time right now where we have a whole spectrum of gender identity, and maybe it's different things that different people need to look at. But the principles are interesting, and the thing about Cooper and Diane is they are very traditionally feminine and masculine, and it happens to fit very well that Cooper is very much expressing that animus energy. He's a lawman, and he has a gun, and he goes out and he acts. And that Diane could then represent his anima, his feelings, his heart. That he literally in the first two seasons holds in his hand and pours all his deepest, most intimate thoughts into. So it happens to fit with those two characters, but I would suggest that it might show itself differently for different people for different reasons. So for this reason, we are going to go into some kind of heteronormative terminology a few times potentially, but I put that out there that I don't want to really characterize gender in that way. It's just energies that we're working with. So if Diane is Cooper's anima, something we didn't talk about just now when we were going through the plot was there's actually a really interesting moment. I don't know if you've noticed towards the end of season two where Cooper actually stops talking to Diane. And there's a good like five episodes. So like episode 19, that's the last time he talks to her for a full five episodes until he picks her up again in I think it's part 24, sorry, episode 24. So I think that's really crucial because if Diane is Cooper's anima and is this important part of his psyche and he stops talking to her, that signifies to us someone who's abandoning it very much. Did you have any thoughts about this gap that happens?
Whenever I think of anything that goes on around that part of season two, I just think of like there's a lot of shakeups in terms of what they want to do. Actually, strange enough, one of which was originally supposed to be the Cooper and Audrey romance blossoming. So I am curious if Diane would have been more prominent or less prominent in that case. But I think that with how we have it as it is, I think it is very telling that he does talk about, I think before that gap, it's when he's I think it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's when he's has to deal with everything at Dead Dog Farm, and he talks up to Diane about how he hopes it's not too late to start a family. I'm pretty sure that in that five episode gap, is that when he meets Annie? I feel like there's a distinct, he talks about Audrey and then a lot of stuff about family, and then Annie starts cropping up. Even if she's not the first one, it's pretty early on because I know that's when everything about Wyndham Earl is starting to come out. So there is, I think, whether you want to talk about whether it's the romantic stuff with Audrey or Annie, or the Laura Palmer case is solved and then Wyndham Earl starting to emerge, there is a little bit of a convenience to be said about why he is going that long, and why he would be waiting that long to talk.
Yeah, so definitely on a practical level, like you say, a lot is going on, but also he's suspended from the FBI, so in a way he's not with the FBI anymore. And so if Diane is his secretary, it doesn't make sense to talk to her. But once again, he talks to her about his most intimate feelings, and he stops doing that for a good long time. And I think that's really important, that even if it's for practical reasons, there's also a Cooper who neglects a part of himself for a good long time. We can also say that outside of the story, some pretty bad script writing is happening and during this time. And basically, when he starts talking to Diane again, it's the Lynch directed episode. I believe it's when it's actually the one where he meets Annie, I think. When I was just trying to notice when I was went through the episodes, Lynch is just really coming back there towards the end of the season, saying, "By the way, this was about all of these things." And he makes this absolutely wonderful scene where Cole, Truman, Cooper are all out in the diner, and they just fall in love all across the board. Gordon Cole has a thing for Shelley, and Cooper meets Annie, and it's just so wonderful. But it's also so heightened, and once again, it's to do with Cooper's projection of onto women as these kind of objects of his desire, rather than people to truly adore. Because I don't think there's anything about the any relationship that is really genuine. I think I'm going to come back to this, but there's a difference between loving someone and being in love. So being in love is a heightened feeling, and it's a wonderful feeling, but it's one where you sort of see everything that you would love to see about a person. But loving somebody is to know them. And so I think that's how he treats Annie. He doesn't actually know her. He's just like totally smitten with her. So when he then picks up Diane in that episode, I think that's where he says, "Let me, I should tell you sometime about Annie Blackburn." Or I think he maybe starts talking about her or something like that. It's a very few times towards the end of season two that he actually talks to her, and it's very compressed. And I think maybe it is the first time he picks it up. He's like talking to her, and then to Diane, and then he sees Annie, and he gets distracted, so he puts down the dictaphone. So it's like pretty clear that like his mind is somewhere else now. So even though Lynch is saying, "Remember Diane," the decline is already happening. So, and this is what I want to talk about, which is basically like the downfall of Agent Cooper, where again I think this relationship to Diane as his anima, it signifies all of that by the way that he neglects her, and then his treatment of her in season three, which is detrimental. But I think this decline goes way back. So we see it happening in throughout season two and one, or maybe you can say it's basically from the beginning of season two, probably starting already with the shooting by Josie, which we might also return to and what that means, and then going forward from there. But then also we are then served this backstory, which is all about Caroline, Wyndham Earle's wife that died, and this becomes very important to the season two finale, because it's where he's confronted with all of that, and there's a lot of echoing backwards and forwards of his relationship with Annie Blackburn. But I would also say, and this is why I mentioned Josie, the fact that he is shot by Josie in the stomach. But when we see him sort of reliving this moment with Caroline in the Black Lodge, he's also bleeding from his stomach. I think he said he got stabbed, right? And I think it says so in the My Life, My Tapes.
Yeah, I think it was something. I think with Wyndham Earle, it has to do with like how he stabs around the heart or doesn't stab, where it's like he was very deliberate about making sure Cooper would survive.
Yeah, so even if it's a stabbing or a shooting, he's shot very similar places for some reason. Being shot or stabbed is like physically wounding you, but you could also talk about how it wounds your soul. It's basically like when what Jung talks about, of course, is like in your process of what he calls individuation, basically like becoming yourself throughout your life. you will have these big wounds. And many scholars have looked at famous myths to kind of parallel this. So one of the myths is about the Fisher King from Arthurian legend, which then makes us just sort of make a little side note to the whole fact that we have a lot of Arthurian references throughout Twin Peaks. Glastonbury Grove, and then later it's Lancelot Court where he lives and stuff. So, but from the part from the Fisher King myth is all about this wounding that brings about change. So every time you go through a huge change in your life, it will hurt you very badly because change is hard. But the question is then, do you deal with that or do you ignore it, or where do you go from there? And so I would say that these wounding moments in Cooper's life are very pivotal to his whole development as a character. There's a Jungian analyst called Robert A. Johnson who one of his way of explaining what happens to an anima when you neglect it is he says, if you are unconscious of your anima, it will marry your shadow. And I found that term really interesting. So another archetype of Jungian psychology is that of the shadow. And the shadow is everything we have suppressed in ourselves, but it can be both good and bad. And all of the archetypes have good and bad sides. So we're also going to now talk about the reverse of the anima, because I would suggest that the anima that Cooper talks to in the shape of the dictaphone is the positive one. Obviously, she's a vessel for all his intimate thoughts. In fact, I want to quickly backtrack and say when he has been shot by Josie, I would suggest that we see the most intimate side of Cooper when he is just on the brink of death and he's talking about what he would like to experience. So the shadow can be both good and bad, and to distinguish those two, you can talk about the dark shadow and the golden shadow. And this terminology is very nice because we know Lynch really loves the word gold and the idea of gold and gold as being this sort of potential higher quality you can engage with. So, you know, on a mundane level, when you go through life, people will tell you a lot of things that are bad. And obviously, like killing is bad, stealing is bad, but some people might also tell you, don't show off. Don't think you're better than other people and stuff. And so there are also potentially good things that could be suppressed and could then, as the theory goes, if you suppress an archetype, it comes out in its most primitive form. So there can also be good things that can be suppressed. But what happens to Cooper when he goes into the lodge is this, in Hawke's words, imperfect soul who has abandoned the most important part of his psyche, his anima, is his soul is split into many forms, and one of them is as his shadow that takes over. And so he's banished to the lodge for 25 years, and his shadow it gets to take his place and walk around in the world. And that is, of course, Mr. C, everything bad about Cooper. Which once again, I would say we have seen many times throughout season two. It's not that Cooper was just this great guy all the time. Like he has his moments where this kind of darkness shines through, and this gets to then get expressed in its most extreme form. And so, what does it do? I mean, it goes and finds the shadow, the anima. As one of its first goals, is it 3 years later, he visits Diane and he marries her in a sense, to use the terminology, the shadow marries the anima. So he rapes her and he sends the good anima to the lodge and he brings out the worst one and places her. And when you suppress your anima, and your anima is in a sense your soul, you then become this soulless person. And so that's what we see as Mr. C. He's just this void. There's nothing. And I'm the listeners can't see that I'm pointing to my chest because I think this is really crucial. the symbology of the chest, because this is what we see when Talbot Diane is seeing Mr. C in the prison. Is there's nothing there. There's just nothing there. And if there is nothing there, quote unquote, in your chest, you just become this void that is endlessly consuming. And that then gets expressed in this awful form as Mr. C, as this, yeah, endlessly consuming, quote unquote, gammonbosia energy that just needs to constantly feed on things. So that gets then expressed as this desire for power and domination. It's toxic masculinity in its worst form. As he says, I don't need, I want. He takes, and we know this sentence is really important because we've heard Cooper say the opposite early on when he was a bit more in balance with his anima. He said the opposite, but now his shadow has taken over and he just consumes. But another thing that happens when you are in this state is that you project your desires outwards, rather than finding the feminine, quote unquote, if you are in this case a heterosexual male, rather than finding it within, you are projecting it outwards. And so it gets cast out onto the women around him. And so it becomes this exploitation of women. And so we see that happening, of course, with Diane. Diane gets raped by him. Audrey does too. And Daria gets killed by him, his sexual energy almost. The only one who can handle it is Chantal. And I would say Chantal is a soulless woman. So that's why she can handle it. So I just wanted to add also again to this thing of the flipping of the anima. So she becomes the reverse. And that's where I would also say that the relationship between Cooper and Diane is the mirror image of that, because up until now she was the dictaphone vessel that received his information. Now, as Mr. C, he does not express himself. That's up to her. Like, she's his kind of minion to do stuff for him, and she reports back to him. Yeah, and so like I said, there is both a dark and a light side to the anima, and so the light side is the one I would suggest being sent to the lodge in the case of Nato. And I think Nato is interesting because she is kind of like the dictaphone still. This is why I kind of like to think of this as not necessarily a real person, but like more of a manifestation of something. And so everything we knew that was good about Diane in the shape of the dictaphone is what she's manifested as in the lodge. So she is unable to see, and she's not really able to communicate, but she can hear, and she can sort of sense her way around the world clearly. But she's also a bit of an abomination, right? And she's sort of, you can also add to that and say, well, Mr. C also kind of manipulated or like sort of trapped her in her own body in a way, but she is really like the manifestation of the dictaphone we already saw. And her negative side, Talbot Diane, is like I said again, the reverse, really negative, opposite image. So she is extremely negative. Fuck you, Albert. Fuck you, Tammy. Yeah, just really expressive. And as I said earlier, like, she is maybe a version of the real Diane. Like, we don't really know who Diane actually is, but she's an extreme, and so she is very expressive. And when you talk about the anima, some of the negative anima, some of the archetypes that are sometimes then sort of correlated with that is that of the whore and the snake. And so the whore is seductive and the snake is cunning. What we see with Diane when we meet her as the tulpa is there's a suitor, or there's a guy leaving her home, and it seems to suggest that there's maybe a string of these guys who like her. That's the whore. And then again, she works as this double agent for Cooper, and she's very cunning, like a snake. And I would just, when I say this is, these are just archetypal images. When I say snake, I also want to point out the fact that she's got dragons on her Asian top that she wears, the blue one that she wears later on. And dragons in folklore have often been sort of interchangeable with snakes. So she's actually wearing this kind of imagery of the snake. And other than that, she also chain smokes. And yeah, she swears like there's no tomorrow. And I think that's a side note, but I just want to point out, you know, smoking in Twin Peaks, there's always something kind of bad about it. It's basically like the forest that's been lit on fire in your mouth or something like that. But we also know that David Lynch loves smoking, so he doesn't quite abandon it entirely. And he allows his holy character of coal to just indulge in it a little bit. Yeah, so like I said, there literally is no heart in Diane left. There's no soul, and this is why she then marries the soulless side of Cooper because he abandons her. He stops talking to her. And yeah, just to get back to this whole thing of like objectifying women and all that, you know, so as Mr. C in his most extreme form, that comes out as like exploitative. But the Cooper that we see, the quote unquote real Cooper that we see, is a little bit more noble than that. But I still think, you know, I think Mr. C is the extreme expression of that, but it's shining a light on the fact that what Cooper is up to is not particularly good. And we've talked about this quite a few times today already, that, you know, he projects his sense of goodness onto these women. And so he uses them as these things, these damsels in distress to save. And Jung has a good quote, which is, "I'd rather be whole than good." And that says a lot about this thing that, you know, you can't be extremely good or you can't be extremely bad. You have to work with the archetypes within your psyche, and you have to make them work together so that you can become a whole person. Did you also recently see this post from Vinny Gedera of 12 Rainbow Trout, where he posted an early draft of Fire Walk With Me that he had been given by Phoebe Agustin?
I did. I actually saw that. I think it was like probably a couple weeks ago at this point, at least the time of this recording.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw like what he wrote, but he said curiously in an early script or early draft of Fire Walk With Me, there was apparently supposed to be a sex scene between Cooper and Laura.
Yeah, that was actually covered by Scott Ryan and Your Lore Disappeared. It's one of those reasons why I'm glad that Kyle MacLachlan was reluctant to come back as Cooper originally, because of that, they had to put Annie in the bed and, of course, removing any of the sexual aspects. Yeah, because me and Emily Marinelli and Ben Brine on Twin Peaks Unwrapped, we actually did discuss this scene, and we just thought it just felt wrong. Like maybe that would have been the point in the event that was filmed, but there was something where we were all just kind of glad that it wasn't filmed, but at the same time, it does fit in pretty well with what you're talking about. And actually, on a similar note, Mark Frost brought up in conversation with Mark Frost that he's actually always been fascinated by Carl Jung and his writings. So it kind of makes me wonder how much of this was influenced even from the early days of the original series, or maybe even the pilot.
It is just striking that there's so much terminology that echoes Jungian theory. So even if it's not like completely like they're trying to match everything onto it, but I almost think they do. I mean, it is the shadow and the golden shadow as Dougie and Mr. C that are being split apart, and all that kind of stuff. If anything, it's inspired potentially from some of these things, and like you say, that's what I wanted to say about this sex scene between Cooper and Laura. Now, again, I don't know exactly how it plays out, but like if you think about it in symbolic terms, you can say, well, you know, this would be a very explicit way of showing Cooper's objectification of Laura. I think what we get, you know, is a little bit more tasteful. It's not so much more tasteful because there are still two rapes that happen, not to Laura. And I was talking to my husband about this, like, what is that quote unquote shadow it triggers in us when we all find that like extremely appalling, this thought that Cooper would have sex with Laura? And maybe it's just like, just don't go there. Like, minor, and she's a victim of incest, and Like, it's just too dark. Let's just not go down that road. But that would make me argue that, like, this is what Lynch does. So maybe Mark Frost is the one who's a bit more conscious about these things and a little bit more sort of, yeah, again, consciously thinking about these things. I think Lynch naturally taps into a lot of these concepts, which is to do with, you know, just looking at the darkest, deepest recesses of the human psyche and shining a light upon them. That maybe gives me a little bit of a side note, which is, well, we can use these things to kind of uncover interesting things about all this. We also must ask ourselves the question of, like, what is it even for? And that's where I personally come from the school of you can use the story that you consume to inform your own life. So if you think of the concept of archetypes, you can see these archetypes expressed in many different forms in many different stories, and it can provoke you to have a look at that, because the theory goes that if you have a strong reaction to a character, whether it's good or bad, it reflects an archetypal side of yourself. So if you have a very strong negative reaction to a character, it might say something about your dark shadow that you might like want to look at. Or if you have a very positive reaction, that might say something about your golden shadow, which is all your sort of potential for creativity that you could unlock when if you ask yourself, why is it I feel this way? So, you know, it's not very hard to say if we feel really bad about the idea of Cooper being with Laura, it's probably just as simple as it's just wrong. But you can use that same kind of reaction with other things to maybe actually uncover something quite important about yourself in order to make it conscious, in order for you to become a more enlightened and more whole person. Because this is what Cooper's journey is about. It's about becoming a whole person. But as I said, it's better to be whole than good. And he has just this warped idea about what goodness is. And we've already heard Mark Frost talk quite explicitly about this as being his white knight syndrome that he fights with. Yeah. And this is sort of like the main theme of it. Quickly gonna backtrack real quick. It's to do with the order of my notes. When Cooper, well, actually, it is in the year of these things because it's to do with kind of Cooper's choices and all that. If we look back at episode 19, when Cooper then stops talking to Diane for a good 5 episodes, it's quite striking to me that in the same scene, he picks up the Bookhouse Boys insignia and kind of flirts with it. So, like, he's just stopped talking to Diane, and then we see a close-up of the insignia that Sheriff Truman gave him only a little bit prior to that. And if I'm not wrong, I think the whole Dead Dog Farm thing is that he gets deputized by Sheriff Truman, and he becomes a sheriff. But I would still say that there must be a reason why we're showing this insignia, because he's kind of flirting again with this idea of this unlawful but still very noble knighthood of Twin Peaks. The Bookhouse Boys are the knights of Twin Peaks, and once again we get back to this Arthurian imagery that we have. And to me, it's just that the Bookhouse Boys are good, but it's the downfall of Cooper to be engaging with them, because he's an FBI agent. There are rules, and he's sworn to obey them. And while noble, part of what gets him in trouble is going out of his jurisdiction in order to save Audrey, when he could have done things the right way. And you also see him struggle with that. Ironically, the moment he then gets suspended from the FBI, he actually gets kind of pushed towards this stuff, because he can't be an FBI agent now. So this stuff that's already kind of brought him in trouble is interesting to him. And to that end, I just want to quickly make a quick reference to Benjamin Mackie's tarot cards, which we also talked about when we talked about Audrey Horne. And I will just point out, you know, the Bookhouse Boys insignia is a sword in front of a tree, and the card that Benjamin Mackey chooses for Diane. And I won't really talk too much about what tarot is, but if you know, you know, or otherwise go and look it up. But basically, tarot is just these cards that you can use for divination, but you can also use their symbology in many ways. And potent imagery, it certainly is. And there are sort of already traditional suits in tarot that Benjamin Mackey in his deck, which is a basically like a fan deck that uses Twin Peaks imagery in as a placeholder. He has some other suits, but he generally references the same ideas. And so for Diane, he funnily enough chooses the only card other than what you would call the aces in a tarot deck that doesn't have a person in it, and that's the Three of Swords. And traditionally, that card has a heart and then three swords poking into it. And so in his image, instead of the heart, you have the dictaphone and three swords poking into it. And so we've already established that the swords are the bookhouse boys. It's the knighthood. In tarot, the swords would signify the element of air, which is also interesting. I'll say something about that in a second. But it also signifies intellect. And so if Cooper is animus energy, intellect, reasoning, signify that, and the men of the noble knights of the bookhouse boys kind of symbolizes that. I think with his tarot cards there, Benjamin Mackey is suggesting to us that this energy is being fucking poked into Cooper's heart and it's killing it. So, and that again gets me back to this whole thing of why I think the symbol of the heart is very important with Diane. And I think it's so wonderful that that's the card he chose for Diane and that's that situation because the heart is missing when Cooper's shadow is out in the world. At the same time as he starts flirting with the idea of the bookhouse boys, the character Denise Bryson arrives in Twin Peaks. And first of all, you could say Denise, kind of the name Denise, Dennis, which is her masculine alter ego, kind of reminds us a little bit of Diane, the name Diane. But more importantly, this is a person who is extreme, is a biological man who is extremely comfortable with their feminine side and is almost wearing it on their sleeve. In fact, they've become a woman. They are a woman. And so I just think that's really interesting or like really potent, you know, that the fact that this person who is extremely comfortable in themselves arrives at this moment where Cooper, quote unquote, goes native and sort of lets go of all the things that defined him because he's wounded. He has to go fishing for a while because he has to work with some things. But the point is, he doesn't do that very well and he kind of skips some important steps in his development. My husband pointed out a really wonderful fact, which is when we meet Denise Bryson in season three, what is it that Cole says to her? I told them to fix their hearts or die. So accepting a transgender person is the same as fixing your heart. So once again, if you think of it in the terms of the anima and the animus, this is all about fixing your heart and becoming a whole person. So like I said, if you think of it in heteronormative terms, you have a guy who needs to look at his anima. But once again, it doesn't matter. It's about the relationship between the anima and the animus. And depending on who you are, you may need to look at different aspects about yourself. And a journey through life is all about this balance. It's like walking a tightrope. You go to different extremes. And this is once again what we see in season three. We see a guy just connecting with his outermost extremes in different ways. So this union between the anima and the animus is what Jung calls the syzygy. There's some kind of etymology to that word, but it basically means yoking together. So it's to do with this kind of union between these two. They have to basically just become one. And quick side note, which is just about if it's about these two extremes that have to be balanced, the reason why I think this is really relevant to Twin Peaks is because Twin Peaks is all about dualism. It's called Twin Peaks, for fuck's sake. It's all about, and it deals with the concepts of the White Lodge and the Black Lodge. There's like, for example, you've got Maddie and Laura, who's played by the same actress, but one is a brunette and one is a blonde. And it's all about doppelgangers and tulpas. And so Twin Peaks is all about this. And this is why we can kind of talk about it in these very binary terms of extremes, but it's all about the union between them. When I talked about Cooper talking to Diane when he was on the brink of death, it's curious to note that the stuff he talks about, other than like extremely intimate to him, also seems to suggest this kind of understanding that life is about balance. So he says, "I want to climb a small hill, not too tall, or I want to climb a tall hill, not too tall. I want to sit in the cool grass, not too cool, and feel the sun on my face." And that suggests to me this kind of balancing. He knows, like, oh, not too tall, not too small, not too cold, not too hot. A feeling of well-being is a balanced one. In lieu of that, he then says, "I would love to make love to a woman I have genuine affection for." And so once again, I come back to this whole thing that this is about Cooper and his relationship to the women around him, because this sentence suggests to me that this is a person who has not felt genuine love. He desires it, but he hasn't actually felt it. So this is what he needs to experience. But unfortunately for Cooper, the union he chooses to have towards the end of season two is one where he once again has objectified his anima as this external thing that's just there to serve a purpose. And so I think that's what happens in that sex scene, is that his anima is not with him. As we've already established this in quite a lot of detail already around that, like she sees herself leaving the hotel room before she's even going in there, because there's no love there. She knows he doesn't love her. And so, as I said earlier, there's a difference between loving someone and being in love. And I think it's curious that when we say that someone is in love with somebody, we also say that it's their object of desire. And so the word object just kind of springs out to me there, because he treats her like an object. She's an actual dictaphone he holds in his hand. Yeah, sorry, I have a lot of notes about the stuff we've already talked about season the like the end part. So like I said, I think he just makes the wrong choices. I think he just skips very important steps in his own development. He's just got this kind of higher idea about being noble that drives him. And I was thinking about a lot about like the killing of Mr. C. And I think, just to get back to what we were talking about, the superimposing of Cooper's face the moment he kills Mr. C, I think that's exactly the point, is that you can't kill your shadow. You have to integrate it. It's a part of you. You can't kill it. You can't ignore it. It's there. So this is just a fantasy. And so I think the moment he does that, he actually splits. So he's been split up symbolically in his golden and dark shadow, but really his inner deepest recesses are splitting apart now. He just realizes this is not real. You can't do that. Or maybe he doesn't even realize this, but he feels it. And I don't know about you, but the first time I saw that, I felt really out of place. I just felt like, oh God, this is not right. Like, there's something wrong. And this imagery of the face superimposed, this is really like, it makes you feel really out of place and you don't know what's happening. And then obviously everything that comes after, just like, okay, this is fucking detrimental. This is a bad choice. And so 10 is the number of completion. Well, I think it just t tells us that at 253, that's when you're supposed to be ready. But this is the moment. This is a very crucial moment. But this guy has handled it all backwards. This is not the moment of completion for him, and that's why I think the figure eight symbol is important, and why, as I said, the scene with the fireman could potentially be placed in either place in the story, because I think it starts over And then maybe it's another journey. But maybe realistically, this is the journey of a soul. It's one that you go through in many incarnations. I know that I don't know too much about what Lynch is into, but I've heard him say the words the great wheel of life and death or something like that. And he does seem to have this kind of reincarnation concept that he buys into, where he says not only individuals have to go through that, but us as a humanity has to. And he says the bad news is we're a long time, there's a long way to go. And that's what the fireman says to him: you are very far away. So I think he's got a long, long way to go. So in lieu of all the things I've said, where Cooper does all this projection onto these women, just to get back to the scene at Eat at Judy's, where he is Richard, as we were discussing, there's something really weird about all of that. I think it was my husband who suggested, like, maybe that's also a projection. Maybe that waitress is not being harassed by those cowboys. Maybe that's what he's seeing. Like, he's seeing yet another person he can save. Maybe that's not actually what's happening, but that's just his excuse to confront them. You could go as far as say that when he gets to Carrie Pace's home, maybe there isn't a dead guy in the corner. Who knows? Like, is he really in trouble or what? Like, and even so, what business does he have? It's not his problem. It's not he's solved a murder. Just let it go, dude. Leave it alone. Do you have anything to add about that?
I guess for the last part, in all fairness, in the case of Cooper, and this is really the only, I guess, quote unquote positive thing, is that he kind of put, in my opinion, he kind of put Carrie Page in that situation to begin with. So he already did enough damage trying to rescue her in part 17. So I think he's
Exactly.
trying to right the wrongs, but even when he's at her door, because he asks, like, are you Laura Palmer? There's no reaction. Is your father Leland Palmer? No reaction. And then it's like, is your mother Sarah Palmer? And you can just tell it's like uneasing her at the thought of just something, there's something tangible that's there for her. So even when he does try to rescue her, both in part 17 and this case, part 18, it just seems like he's always making, like, making things worse. Like, whatever he tries to help people. And again, I think this is why we were talking about with Diane, is that he has like such like a unique relationship with her, because he does share all these thoughts to her, but also the fact that he is treating her as an object by part 18, that's very telling of his mindset, certainly by that point. And the fact that this is the last time we see Cooper, at least in order of release, and I guess you could say chronological order, it does leave a bad mark on like what it says about him and how he treats Diane.
It really is just my in to kind of explain, like, what is this role that Diane is, and why is it that she's brought in like this at the end. And I think it's just because he's such a crucial part of his psyche, essentially. I also want to point out that when he Richard puts those guns into the frying oil, it reminds me a little bit of the House Annie scene with his doppelganger, where he takes the toothpaste and like squeezes it into the sink. There's this kind of like just like curious like testing of the world or something in a way that's like completely off. It seems very similar to me. It's like he has no plan. He's just gonna put them in there now, and then he seems to realize that they're probably gonna go off in a moment. So he says that to the staff. But the reason why I'm again saying this thing of maybe he's projecting this stuff onto this waitress, is because when he fucks up those guys, like, they're pretty tough guys by the way he sees them in his quote unquote dream. But he comes across as the scariest person. Like, everybody else is totally scared of him, like the staff and the other people in the diner. So, who's the bad guy in this situation?
One thing that might add credence to yours and Anton's theory that the Cowboys might not even be real. I always mess up the order whenever I talk about it, but I swear it's like he takes three guns from all three of the Cowboys, and there's the one who won't give up the gun until he asks like a second or third time. But then I think he only puts two in the deep fryer. I just remember the first time I watched that part of the trailer, I thought, oh, this feels like a blatant plot hole. But then I thought, no, this is in part 18. There's probably something to it. And even if it's not, it's still a thing that's worth thinking about. So I think you and Anton are onto something about whether the Cowboys could have been real, or even if they are, there's still something about that quote unquote missing gun that's worth discussing.
Yeah, that's a nice thing. I hadn't really thought about that, say on a practical level. Maybe he wants to bring a gun, but like, why does he need to bring a gun? Because like, what are you up to, dude, bringing a gun anywhere? I know in America there's a different relationship to guns, but like, yeah, and which is what David Lynch also makes season three about. Obviously, there's the whole scene with the gun, the little kid that accidentally shoots a gun, and there's a little bit of a comment on our relationship to guns. But I'm sure someone would look at this thing of the trinity of these guns and say, well, maybe one is being favored and some are being put aside or something like that. He takes himself onwards from that moment, but he's abandoned. In this case, I would maybe say the Trinity is like, other than like the different aspects of Cooper, there's the Cole, Cooper, Diane Trinity that walks towards the door, towards the end. Because not only is Diane important, Cole is also important. And I haven't really explored that because this is not a Cole episode, but just more like, if he's like the mentor or something in an archetypal sense, he's really important too. He's also an informant of Cooper's soul. And so he's symbolically abandoning these parts of him also in by that gesture.
And I think that the build-up to all this was really well worth it. Was there anything else we should wrap up with Diane, now that we've discussed everything, such as the Jungian theory, how Cooper factors into it, and how Diane is represented in the tarot cards?
Well, just a little bit of a side note was just to say, well, if you've got the dark shadow, then you have the golden shadow as well, and that's only just to very quickly say something about Janie E, which was just to say, okay, so what is the golden shadow to a person? A golden shadow is all of their potential. It's all the positive things. And you might find the golden shadow, as I said, or any archetype within you by the reaction you have to your exterior world. So I think this is a fun way of looking at Dougie, which is what is it? What are the reactions that Cooper has? Oh yeah, sorry, I realize what it is I'm getting to now because I'm getting back to the thing that I was gonna say about Las Vegas being the least spiritual place on the planet. So if Cooper's strong positive reactions to things are a certain thing they're expressed through his golden shadow, Dougie. So, what is it Cooper reacts to? He reacts to damn fine coffee and cherry pie, but he has a general positive reaction to Twin Peaks. It's a really lovely place. He might make a little bit of light of it. So he says, "Why am I whittling?" "Okay, I'll bite," says Harry Truman. That's because that's what you do in a town where yellow light still means stop. So he's making a little bit of fun of it, but he really loves it. He's a city slicker. That's what we've been told. He comes from the bustling Philadelphia, and he's now come to this place. And as we see throughout the seasons, he gets to really admire it to such a degree that he thinks about settling down there. I would say that the whole dead dog farm thing again is weird and off. What the fuck? He flips a coin and then he gets him to this place that has to do with his whole thing. It's not about real estate. Yeah, fuck that. That's not what it's about. This is again Cooper's dark side that's seeking out problems, I think. Maybe also trying to solve them, but mostly just getting himself in trouble because he gets into the whole confrontation with Jean Reno. So, Cooper loves Twin Peaks, and I think this is the point. His dark shadow could have put him in Twin Peaks, where he could have connected with his golden shadow and be the best version of himself. But no, he traps him because the dark shadow has taken over. So the dark shadow has put him in Las Vegas. So he is in another city, and it's a really bad one. We don't know a lot about Philadelphia really from Twin Peaks, but we know about David Lynch's relationship to Philadelphia as this pretty dark place. But Las Vegas is a place that kind of suppresses the darkness that is just at the same time, like totally there. Like it's all bad energy. I mean, I've been to Las Vegas. I think it's cool. It's fun. But it's who do we meet in Las Vegas? We meet a bunch of gangsters, right? Like this is mafia. This is gambling. And like when Cooper is walking through the Silver Mustang casino, he sees a homeless woman and like someone who's really like at the worst place in their life and stuff. And he lives in this suburban area that is like a lot of people who are actually really poor. Like this is the whole point with him, with Dougie and Jeannie. They don't have any money and they're being totally exploited by the banks and everything. And the place he manifests is this like abandoned part of the real estate that's just kind of gone into decline and all that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty bad place. So Janie E, I think that's just where, if you say that Diane is the negative anima, Talba Diane is the negative anima, then her sister is maybe potentially an extension of that. So her sister, like Janie E, is not bad, but she has similar traits. Like she's really expressive and very dominating. Something I thought about, but I haven't really explored, which maybe you can shine a light on, which is just the fun imagery, which is okay. So Cooper has sex with Diane at the end. She's on top, but we know that he is pretty much exploiting her at this time. What does it say about us that Janie is on top of Dougie and they're having a very good time?
There's definitely a huge contrast between Dougie's facial expression versus Richard's, where it's like clearly meant to be more of a humorous part, but no, it's there is definitely a stark contrast between like how the two, like the as you said, the gold self and then the shadow self, where it's like if Dougie is like this pure pure part of Cooper, and then Mr. C is like the shadow, and like what it's like how when they're separate. And I guess Richard is emblematic of when those two are combined.
Yeah. So just in lieu of all this Jungian theory, this is a fun little observation I made, which was when you talk about this psyche, you also have the archetype of the self, which is basically everything you are, everything you could potentially be, and your ego is your consciousness, that kind of the little percentage that is consciously aware of all of your potential. And the way the self is often symbolized is as an ocean. And where do we see an ocean? We see an ocean in season 3 as the great big ocean where the fireman's castle is. And it's also the ocean that Cooper overlooks before he meets NATO. And so, and the image of the ego is often like a cork that's just kind of floating in that ocean. So it's just suggesting to me like all the signs are there for Cooper. Your anima is hidden away in the self, and there she is, and you could potentially be conscious of her and integrate her, but he doesn't even recognize her. He has no idea, and she's the conscious one. She's the one who's talking. So that was just a fun little observation. But lastly, I think we just need to address this important thing, which is the Orientalism of Diane, which I think is a fair term to be using because potentially is a bit problematic, but we can talk about it. And I have some like very vague suggestions as to how it could potentially be intentional by David Lynch, but I think it's a little bit hard. I think we just need to address it. So talking about NATO, she is Asian woman, like Diane is a white woman who's trapped in the body of an Asian woman. The actress is Japanese, but this is not in any way relevant or addressed. She's just Asian, and it almost gets a little bit worse by the fact that her deformity in her eyes is kind of indicating the kind of slit eyes of the very stereotypical idea of like Asian eyes. There's probably a term for that, the derogatory term for this stereotypical imagery. And then on top of that, you have Talba Diane wearing Asian clothing. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
I guess if we're going to talk about more so, I guess the behind the scenes aspect, I don't think there's anything that was any malice that was coming from Frost or Lynch. I think that with what I think of when I first see Diane, and I believe it's part six, we're seeing her wearing like the red Asian themed shirt that she has. And I think that was more so to exemplify definitely the color red, that there was something to keep an eye out for Diane. And also I think there was, I don't know if like they want to make her seem like quote unquote exotic, but there's something more stand out about her, that there's something about like her personality that it'll just be a little bit different. And because you have Gordon Cole, you have Albert and Tammy, where they're wearing just kind of like these regular suits, but then there's like this splash of color with everything that Diane has. And they also happen to be colors that Lynch seems to really love as well, such as red and blue. So I think they just want to add that extra splash to kind of add to Diane's personality. Because it's like we were saying before, is that with the Tulpa, there is more of this like intensity of her, like the whole fuck you, Albert, fuck you, Tammy. And I think it was more so just, like I said, the color and just the style that they were gravitating towards more than anything that could have been misconstrued as offensive.
Yeah, it's striking that the quote unquote real Diane that we potentially see at the end is actually quite underdressed, except for the red hair. She's actually really underdressed and a bit unassuming looking. And so again, if her tulpa is this negative anima expression, she's a lot more sort of flamboyant and looking and all like really like stylish. And just expressive in every way. And I think now you're just talking about the styling of her, and I actually think like there's something a little bit kind of 40s, but like neo 40s about her look. It's like a modern interpretation of some very classic, very 40s look, cuts or silhouettes, if you can say like that. So the whole Orientalism of the high collar top is like a fashion, a 40s fashion. So in that way, I think it also, if we're talking about the Asian look or the fact that NATO is Asian as kind of like a signifier for mysterious, I think this also adds to Diane's kind of, can you say, femme fatale kind of look or like signifier. And actually something I realized was that when Albert goes to meet Diane, he meets her at a bar called Max Fun's. And you could say, is that Max von Sydow? No, I think it's the director from Sunset Boulevard. So I'm trying to remember the character's name, but we know that Sunset Boulevard is a movie that David Lynch loves. And curiously enough, he uses the word the name Gordon Cole from Sunset Boulevard, and he has Agent Cooper wake up the moment he watches a scene from Sunset Boulevard. So there's a very clear kind of connection there. And so, Gloria Swanson is the ultimate femme fatale. And so I think this is something there about the fact that Diane is in this particular bar that's named this way, and she's dressed in this very typical 40s and or 50s, or at least sort of like the same kind of stylings as Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard, which we know is from 1950. So there's something there. But she's wearing a Chinese top, and then her other alter ego is Asian, and we must ask ourselves, like, why is this? And again, as we talked about, there's the thing about the mysterious, right? Like we can't help but go back to Josie in the original series, which again, like it's fine, but it is just a little bit problematic, isn't it? It's like the character we see, the only Asian character we see, or only Asian characters. There's of course Jonathan that visits her, but like there are very few minorities in Twin Peaks as it is, and the Asian character we meet here, in this case Chinese, is like held as this like highly mysterious woman that you can never really truly understand. And you also have Catherine Martell dressing up in an Asian attire as Mr. Tochimura and stuff like that. So what is Cooper? Sorry, what is Lynch doing with that? I don't know. I think it's just that this stuff is just a bit mysterious, but it's a little bit funny. If we were to sort of make sense of it with Diane, there are two things. So there's the date at the Chinese restaurant in My Life, My Tapes, And maybe you can say, well, this is sort of trauma embodied in a way. Like, this is the best moment she ever had with Cooper, as we talked about earlier. Like, this, the way she describes this is highly sexualized, and she had a good night with him. And maybe this is just an echo of that night. But is Lynch even like aware of or thinking about My Life, My Tapes? Who knows? But the other thing I also wanted to talk about was, again, to kind of bring it back to Josie. It's like maybe there's just some kind of correlation between this trauma of being shot by Josie. As I said earlier, I think being shot by somebody or stabbed by somebody is really symbolic of the fact that you have to change now. And so if he stops talking to his anima is maybe shedding some light on this stuff. And I actually read on Twin Peaks Wiki that Josie was supposed to be Italian. And that brings me off on the whole rabbit hole, which is when we then talked earlier about Blue Velvet. So if Josie was supposed to be Italian, and if Cooper and Diane are sort of the future of what are called Jeffrey Beaumont and Sandy, if they're the futures of Jeffrey and Sandy, and it's all about the mysterious woman Dorothy Valance, played by Isabella Rossellini, who is Italian, you can then sort of make a leap there and say, the anima is embodying, his desire in a way, and because Josie could have been Italian, but Josie is not Italian; she is Chinese, and so let's have a Asian signifier there or something. It's just a tangent, but.
To bring up the stuff from the original series, when I think of with Josie, how she was supposed to be played by Isabella Rossellini, I think it's worth mentioning that she was seeing David Lynch at the time, and I think that for Lynch, he wanted like the first shot, because the first shot we see is Josie. So I think that the idea of Isabella Rossellini looking in a mirror was probably something he strongly gravitated towards, and they probably wrote with that in mind. In the case of Catherine Martell dressed up as Mr. Tojimura, yeah, I mean, by today's standards, yeah, that's looking, it's not exactly the best look. But at the same time, Piper Laurie, she seemed like she had a lot of fun with the idea that, because I think it was actually up to her that she had these different nationalities that she could pick from. And she thought the whole Mr. Tochamore would be really amusing. And it seemed like, at least for the first date, people were like, who is this guy? But I think people slowly picked up on it. And again, the original series in particular, it was always meant to be more comedic in certain spots. And I feel like with Catherine Martell, that I thought, again, people can say what they will if it's aged poorly or not. But I think at least of the time, it was kind of like a fun way to do it, especially with the reveal when she kisses Pete when she still dresses Mr. Tojimura.
Yeah, it's simply just the like the nationality thing that becomes a bit problematic. But like the whole like dressing up and wearing quote unquote different masks is like a huge theme in Twin Peaks, and it's also cross genderism there. Like she's dressing up as a man and stuff. And again, if I am to then sort of shed a negative light on that, you can say, well, okay, why are they unrecognizable? Why is it that Cooper doesn't recognize Diane as NATO? And why is it that we don't recognize, or we, I mean, she is recognizable enough to the audience, I would think, but maybe the first time you see it, you don't necessarily notice. Why is it she isn't recognizable? Well, that's because she's not only changed her gender, she's also changed her nationality, like to something that's like totally obscure to being a white American. And that's just what I think is a little bit problematic with NATO again, is like, well, it's just that she's mysterious for the fact that she is Asian and totally unlike anything that Diane is. So, but this is why I'm trying to really try and grasp at these little links between the character, like between the story and like Blue Velvet and all that stuff, to just sort of make a little bit sense of it. Because I like to think that Lynch's heart is in the right place and that it's not in any way nefarious. Maybe he's shining a light on that. Maybe he's telling us about Orientalism. I just think it's really tenuous and he's not doing a lot with it. He's telling people to fix their hearts about transgender people, but not necessarily about minorities. And he's actually very bad at representing minorities because there aren't that many of them in Twin Peaks. This is a white town.
One thing I do think of, and I've talked about this with people off the show, is that I think of like, I mean, I'm bringing up something obvious, but Lynch and Frost, they're both white guys from the US where they're just kind of going with what they, I guess, what they know more intimately in terms of like their life experiences. And so when they write a character like Nido, which admittedly, I could make an argument about the whole what Diane is dressed as, like as the Tulpa in particular. The thing with Naito, yeah, I can see why people would have a problem with it, but it's sort of like I bring this up with other directors. Like, for example, you have someone like Spike Lee, where, it's like, a predominantly black cast and like dealing with black issues. And if you had someone like Wes Anderson trying to take on something like that, it would not land at all. And on the other end, if you switch the roles, that would not land either. So I think if it's just like Lynch and Frost, I think they want to add something a little different because they were going, across like different states, different countries in the return. Then of course there's the fantastical aspect with Naito. Again, like I like what you said, I don't think there's any like any contempt or anything that was like anything mean-spirited on their end. I think it's just that when you look at like, their lives growing up, whether you read Room to Dream by David Lynch, read Conversations with Mark Frost, I think they're just trying to do something new, but also when you have certain life experiences and you pour those in, sometimes it comes through and it's very authentic, but sometimes when you try something different, it doesn't always land with audiences. I hope that explains like how I feel about Naito, but because actually I'll be honest, Naito is a character where I'm still trying to think of like how I feel about that character. So I know that my thoughts aren't fully formed on her to even do a full episode for her yet.
Actually, in lieu of that, on the Twin Peaks wiki page for her, they have written the following. In Japanese Buddhism, the term Nado literally translates to inner path, simultaneously describing inner teachings or one within the path of nature and righteousness. And then they talk about the characters of the actual symbols, the Japanese characters, and say, although the character of Nado, I think, is most associated in the West with Chinese Taoism, it is used in East Asia to describe similar concepts in Shintoism and Buddhism, which has been studied by both Lynch and Frost. So this is where I have this quote from the Twin Peaks wiki page. I have not researched it, and I don't know whether it's true. But obviously, somebody put it there just to sort of say maybe there's something there. But like again, once again, like okay, so a almost anagram of Diane is NATO, and it sounds kind of Japanese. So let's just make her a Japanese character. I don't think that's a good sort of reason, but. But the name is interesting. If it means inner path, then obviously, once again, if you can talk about it in many terms, but if you sit to call her his anima, this is where he needs to go and find her, and she is part of his teachings. So that's all right. But quickly, just before you reminded me of the scene of Josie looking in the mirror. Josie is kind of humming a little bit, and that once again kind of echoes to me Nato, who makes these sounds. And so once again you could say, okay, well, what does that even mean? Why is Nato making sounds? And it is almost like kind of reductive idea of Asian people is like making sounds. Again, if you look at it in really nefarious terms, but if you want to be generous, you can say she's echoing some really important stuff. Like she's echoing the first pic image of Twin Peaks, which is really important, and which we are being shown again towards the end. It is what we see when Cooper changes time. So just before he goes into all of that, he meets Diane as Nato, and so it's sort of predetermining some of these important moments. We know that Lynch likes to kind of pick out really important imagery, and another one is like the image of the girl who runs through the courtyard with her face covered and screaming. And that's like the first thing we see when the show starts in season three. So it's like, this is an important image. So this is my generous take on NATO. It's just that she's echoing some kind of link back to Josie, and Josie is important for Cooper in many ways. She is not his love. He is the love interest of his friend, but she is very important. And if we read the Secret History, we know that Cooper spends a lot of time actually researching her, obviously to find out what's up with her for his friend, but like he does spend quite a lot of time with her. So if Diane is his anima and part of his subconscious, maybe she manifests as NATO because she literally is on his mind.
I guess the one last thing I'll mention about the connection between Diane and NATO, I think of like how in the behind the scenes when David Lynch, when they were building the LA set for the sheriff's station for Frank Truman's like larger office, and there's a part where him and I forget who he's talking to, but he's talking about how like this scene will be ready by next week. And Dave Lynch just says, like, I don't know how I'm gonna, I have no idea what I'm gonna do with the scene. It's like, oh no, come on, it's like it'll just be another few days. Like, I've been thinking about this for a long time. And I kind of wonder that, it would be naive to overlook the connection of NATO and also Diane, the Diane told about how she's dressed in more Chinese attire, that there would be a connection. But I wonder if Laura Dern was like asked to come in because they just bring like everyone, like a lot of the legacy characters in at that point. And I was, so I wonder how much Lynch had in mind if Diane would show up at that point, or maybe originally when in the beginning of part 18, if that would have been the first time Cooper and Diane would have seen each other. So I guess the fact that what I'm trying to get at is that since what we have now is that basically part 17 explicitly telling us if they're the same person, that would we look at it differently if it was more strongly implied and that scene wasn't shown?
That's
But
right.
yeah, I think that winds down on Diane. Was there anything else we should do to to keep in mind now that we're talking about everything with like her whole story?
Well, just to kind of clear the air and talk about something that's slightly funnier, this is the last thing, because now we just talked about this very heavy issue of the Orientalism, is that if we think about NATO's sounds, a lot of people have thought about the fact that she kind of echoes Waldo, the minor bird, and that it kind of reminds us of that. And when she's in the sheriff's station, she keeps like making these sounds. And I mean, if we say that Diane is a dictaphone, I think that makes a lot of sense, that she absolved the sounds of the bird.
Yeah, I can go for that. Now that like we've wrapped up on Diane, I know you mentioned everything about your social media and all the stuff you're working on early on the episode, but was there anything else you wanted to have for closing thoughts in terms of what you'd like to plug?
I love Twin Peaks. And Diane, I'll never stop talking about Twin Peaks.
But yeah, no, I wanted to thank you for coming on. That was like incredible insight and very well ironed out in terms of like what Diane brought into Twin Peaks and like everything you brought in, how the younging aspect is something that doesn't get as talked about as much as it probably should be.
Yeah, that was a. I didn't think, as this, in a sense, quite minor character, I didn't think that would be this much. But I spent a lot of time with her, and there's a lot to talk about. So I'm really happy we went all across the board. Thank you so much for having me.